Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, where tyranny is so fabulous that people make sure that the one who is most directly responsible for the tyranny, the Prime Sinister, actually winds up being the most popular man in the country. You're going to love that, right? In fact, you'll love this even better. I was criticising the media for not covering the Prime Minister, John Key, properly and exposing his scumbaggery. And then one of these mainstream media people comes up to me and shows me about 10 articles in mainstream media showing how John Key's been lying all the time. And then another article comes out the very next day saying how he's the most trusted and loved Prime Minister ever. You can't make this stuff up, folks. All right. Okay. Let's try to get a grip. I'm going to go to my guest now, Whittemu Bayliss. Welcome to the program.
G'day, Vinny. How you doing?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response, bro. Hey, here's a joke for you. What do you call a moldy cow?
Uh-oh, here we go.
Whittemu.
Moving on.
Yeah. All right, well, give us a little bit of a background about who you are and what it is you do, bro.
Bit of a background. I'm originally from the sunny metropolis of Porirua, just north of Wellington. But been in the Waikato now for a dozen years or more, and I'm a personal life coach and trying to help people make changes in their lives to lead a bit more of a healthy lifestyle themselves.
Is that what we're going to be talking about today?
I don't know what you've been told, but no, I'm also been dealing with some of those lovely government agencies that you rat bag on a bit. I guess that's partly why I'm here tonight to talk about some of my experiences being a parent without being a parent.
A parent without being a parent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, proceed, because I don't know why you're here today either. I come into these interviews blind, don't know who I'm interviewing or what I'm interviewing them about. There's a lot of work involved with editing and all of that kind of stuff, and that, you know, the whole knowing what you're talking about thing isn't important to me. So, you know, go for your life, son.
All right. No, I guess in part my friend referred me to you is because we've been child, youth, and family caregivers for a young girl for a good part of six and a half, nearly 7 years now. And just on 4 years ago, we underwent Home for Life, basically permanent foster care called Home for Life. And one of the struggles that we've had in our particular situation is that we're dealing with a young girl the child we have in our care, who's 7 years old physically, has fetal alcohol syndrome, a number of other emotional, high emotional needs. In fact, we had a meltdown that's typical when she gets tired, and there's a lot of extra patience, which I'm still learning, and I think every parent needs to learn as they go on. But we're dealing with, in our case, parents, the biological mother, who is a transient alcoholic drug addict, who through the pregnancy, this particular pregnancy, drunk and drugged her way through it, and thus this little girl's got fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Adds another layer of difficulty. And a father who, for all intents and purposes, is a glorified sperm donor. One night stand results in this beautiful little girl, who's also got a child sex conviction against his name, and has in the last year drug us through the courts to try and get access visits to a child he's never met, doesn't know, And where our big issue is, and I guess why I was referred here, is on balance, two biological parents have more rights and on balance have more power than we do who have had this child under our roof for 90% of their life. And that's some of the things that I've been discussing. In fact, this last week I met with the two sitting Hamilton electorate MPs to discuss possible ways of, I guess, restoring the balance back into the hands of the people who have actually got to do the parenting when others aren't capable of doing so.
Well, it's a strange thing, isn't it? The whole aspect of parenting, I think, is just kind of under attack wholesale. You know, if you have a child, your child's not yours anymore. Your child belongs to the state, and it's just a question of whether or not the state wants to take that child from you. Now, if I may, it appears as though there is not adequate representation for children, particularly not in the family courts, and indeed not enough accountability in the family courts. Partly, I believe this is because of the fact that it's actually not possible to report on anything that goes on in the family courts. So if there's any corruption, any unfairness, or anything of that nature, nobody will ever know about it.
I'm not going to deny that there's certainly elements of the family court that couldn't do with improvement. There are various stories that I've heard around judgments that have gone against people who have reasonable cases. I know of a good friend of mine who's a grandfather who's simply just trying to get to be able to have his granddaughter over, for stayovers on the weekend, but because somebody who's not even connected to the family cries foul and makes an accusation, and one psychologist backs up that accusation, even though there's actually no grounds, that he's not actually allowed to have private contact with his granddaughter. And I mean, that's one generation beyond what my wife and I are doing in our home. You know, we're actually directly parenting somebody else's child, we're not talking about a grandparent generation. So, reporting in the family court, I guess there's times when things should be revealed. Absolutely. If there's a vested public interest in it. For example, I think more of the I think if there was issues around, just to pull a case out of the head, the Kahui situation, if there were scenarios in the family court that had played out prior to the actual trial of the dad, then I think that should have come out. I think there should have been more reporting from what had happened in the family court. It was a public interest situation, especially around areas where there's child sex offences and, you know, paedophiles in the mainstream courts that have gone through, well, the people involved have gone through the family courts. I absolutely think that there's a vested public interest in that. In our situation, the family courts treated us pretty good. But that's not to say that it's not balanced in every situation. We had a lawyer who was working for our best interests and represented us extremely well. She was awesome. The lawyer for the child that was appointed eventually by the court, again, was a lawyer for the child that we had worked with previously, who was working for the child's best interests. And fortunately, in this latest situation, the mother, the biological mother, was on the same page as us, and that gave our case extra weight against the dad in this case. So, for us, the family courts worked out very well. I have heard that there are other scenarios out there, and whether reporting would make that more accountable, I don't know. That would have to take the individual's case I think, into account as to whether or not there's a vested public interest in the people knowing.
Mm.
And is it going to damage the families? Is it going to do any, is it going to do good if it's out there?
Yeah. As opposed to the carte blanche, no reporting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Case-by-case basis.
Case-by-case. I think definitely a case-by-case because especially if there's a high-profile situation, again, just pulling that kahui one out of the hat, if they'd been through the family courts before and they're in a civil case where there's, like, for example, how this whole, you know, closed doors that the family that I spoke to a lawyer friend of mine and says, why don't they just arrest them all for obstruction of justice?
Mm.
You know, those kids deserve justice. And whether the dad did it, I don't know. Whether the mum did it, I don't know. But the fact that everybody just shut up shop and I guess had everybody's backs, you know, and whether that was a family.
Is this the one involving Maxina King, was it?
Yeah, but the dad is the one who actually ended up on trial.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually Ian Wishart wrote a book about that called Breaking the Silence.
Yeah.
And he was called by a number of journalists after the fact because when they were reporting on this case in the public sphere and what have you, it was really incomplete, basically, and the public didn't have the idea of what the heck was actually going on during that trial. And a number of those reporters actually called Ian after the release of his book and to say, yeah, mate, you got it right. We totally got it wrong. But what was interesting is before the book came out, there was actually a public campaign who have never read the book, mind you, because it's not even out yet, to say that it should never even be printed and it shouldn't be on the shelves. It should, you know, like, information is illegal. It's kind of the crazed argument here. But for those who are unfamiliar, particularly the international audience, could you explain what the Kahui case actually was? Do you recall very much?
I'll try and get it, and you might fill in the gaps where I miss out. Basically, there was two young children, Chris and Karu Kahui, who died at home, and they were inconclusive. Basically in the public arena anyway. Nobody could be found responsible for the deaths of these two babies, and eventually charges were laid against the father. He was found not guilty of committing the crime he was accused of. So essentially, now these two children have died in the care of their family. If I remember right, there were some very significant injuries suffered by both the children. But nobody still to this day has been found responsible for committing these acts of violence against these two children. That's the case, and that's a Reader's Digest, probably even worse than a Reader's Digest version of the case. But that's what essentially what it was. Two children physically violently died, infants, babies, you know, violently died. And the family basically, you know, shut up shop, refused to talk to police. Eventually the father was hauled before the courts, accused of the murders. He was found not guilty. And again, you know, that argument, not guilty means innocent, well, doesn't mean innocent, but still nobody today has been held responsible for the deaths of those children.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back onto your case now. I mean, why is this significant? Why do people need to hear about it? What are the gory, juicy details of this case?
Basically, you know,
using the words gory and juicy in a case involving a child is probably low tact. I'm sorry.
Low tact. No, well, I mean, just to put everybody's mind at ease, there is no gory and juicy details. That basically what we're – there's two elements for us. One is that whole – even as child, youth and family caregivers or as Home for Life parents, independent of child, youth and family now, we have full responsibility for the day-to-day care of that child. And I'm not even considering financial support that we receive an unsupported child benefit. That's not even a factor for us. We don't care about that. We're grateful for it, don't care about it. But we have the full measure of responsibility for a child in our care, and yet we don't have all the rights and privileges that a parent has. So a family has a child, biologically it's their child. They can make decisions around school, around travel, around anything like that that they want to do, independent of anybody else. They don't have to get anybody's permission to do things or to go places. Under the law, we are technically supposed to consult with this little girl's biological parents over what school she goes to, the fact that we go to church on Sundays, if we travel domestically, we're supposed to, tell them that we're going to go. I might visit my family in Wellington over a long weekend or, over the school holidays. We're supposed to get permission from these two parents for her to travel, even domestically. And if they disagree, then we have to go to a mediation. And if it doesn't get resolved at mediation, then we could end up having to go to court for this matter. So
sounds like the parents of the child get to, for more or less, rule your life in terms of how you spend it with that child.
Pretty much. We're fortunate, as I said earlier, before, on the most part, that the mother is very supportive of us now. It's taken us a long time to garner her trust. But as I said, the balance of power is not with us. And we don't have the support of child, youth and family that we had as caregivers with them holding the custody. So under Home for Life, under the Home for Life program, custody shifts from under the official orders from the chief executive of child, youth and family to us. So she's no longer a child, youth, and family child. She's not in the system, as it were. And so day-to-day care and custody is in us, is vested in us. And we are co-parents with the biological parents. But as you pointed out, the tail can wag the dog. And even the smallest issue, for example, the fact that she goes to a school a block away from us, could become is potential for a court case if the parents, the biologicals, decided to make it so. The court, in all likelihood, in our situation, find in our favor. But again, the fact that it could go to court is a big issue for us. And like I said, there are many parents or there are many people in our situation who have had to go through court cases to justify the fact that the child goes to a particular school.
Sounds like a whole lot of BS to go through for your mate. And, I don't know about you, but I know a lot of parents. And just raising a child, the sleep deprivation, the extra responsibility, the lack of time to yourself, the all of these things that go with being a parent is stressful enough just to try and raise the child right. What mm-hmm. you're talking about is an extra layer of frickin' impediment on top of it for people yep. who don't even take responsibility for the child themselves in any way.
Yep. Just to give you an example, last year when the biological father made his latest play, for supervised access visits, his lawyer hired a private investigator to serve my wife at work. Now, my wife's a teacher, so they actually broke the law to serve my wife at work. And because they didn't go to the reception, They went trolling around the school, trying to find where her classroom was, and the only way they found her was because she left a sign on her door saying, class this period in this room. And then they served her at work. Now, the principal actually sent a letter to his lawyer saying, you are actually in violation of the law to do this, and never got a response from it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a stress that.
What is it a civil matter or a criminal matter that?
That could have become a civil matter. It would have been a whole nother ball game for him to fight. But it was actually funny to think about that. You know, my wife's school was threatening legal action against the lawyer, that a lawyer actually didn't think about it. But that was a stress because, while we understood his desire to, meet his daughter for the first time, our situation or our position really was, let her make the decision when, simply because we've put all this information in front of her in a book that has pictures of her history. It's got pictures of her half-siblings. It's got pictures of her biological mum. It's got pictures of her biological dad. One of the facts is that we brought up in our response to his service was, she's never asked about you. And how are you going to introduce yourself to this girl? Who really still doesn't quite get why her mum can't have her, or she can't be with her mum, her biological mum, despite teaching her at a level that we think she can understand, that she has a sickness. It's called addiction. It doesn't help her make good choices and keep you safe. And that's not fudging anything. These are real things that she has, but we're not telling her that she's a druggie. You know, she's a boozer. She's got a sickness, it's addiction. You know, and just doesn't help her make right decisions and keeping you safe. And she kind of gets that, but forgets it from time to time. The damage that it could do to her, introduced to a complete stranger, and all he could really say is, I'm your daddy. Well, actually, that's my job right now. You know, that's me. People might say I'm being selfish, but damn right, I'm trying to protect this kid from things that are going to hurt her, not just physically, because if he tries something to a seven-year-old girl, you know, is to go with his previous convictions of child sex offences.
Do you know the details of those sex offences, like what he did?
No, we know that there were convictions against a minor. In terms of the specific details, and he admitted that it was a one-time event. And we weren't worried about supervising the visits. Our worry was the emotional and the psychological problems that it could create, and that her pediatric specialist up here and other specialists who know her consider were more risky than his offences. So on balance, that was more worrying to us as her parents than his conviction was, because again, if he tried anything, we'd deal to him. I mean, I'm 6'5 and my wife's 6'2, so you know, we can take care of our own.
Well, irregardless, it doesn't matter how well you can protect a child, because once a child is damaged in a way such as sexual assault and such like that at a tender age, doesn't matter what kind of repercussions happen to the thing, because the damage is done and it's there permanently.
Absolutely.
Not so, worth the risk, I'd say.
No, it's not. And it's being responsible for her, and understanding not only just the physical protection needs, but emotionally, you need to protect her, and psychologically, you need to protect her. And so, This isn't cotton wool stuff. You know, we let her fall off her scooter and fall off her bike, and she can get up and dust herself off and all this stuff. But those underlying issues that meetings like this that you're not prepared for and you rush into can cause a lot more damage and long-term problems. And that's something that we want her to be able to process at a time when she's ready, as opposed to an adult throwing this on her.
That said, what's actually the problem with having a supervised visit?
Again, it comes down to what is he going to say to her? Hi, I'm your dad. And the confusion that will bring into her, because at this point, she's just working out where her mum, her biological mum, fits into the picture. And she gets really upset for a good few days after we have an access visit. And it takes us a while to settle her back down. So it's all good that we could arrange this visit with him, but he doesn't have to deal with the repercussions afterwards.
You do.
We do. And we want, knowing what happens with the mum, knowing what happens post-visits with the mum, we don't want to open this can of worms just yet. We've actually just recently had a confirmed diagnosis of a moderate intellectual disability. And on the scale, you know, you've got mild, medium, and mild, moderate, and high. She's actually in the top third of the moderate section. I mean, she's functional, she can run around, she can walk, but reading Dr. Seuss books for her is a challenge. Let's put it that way.
Hmm.
At seven, you know, you've got to, and even though I don't necessarily agree with the national standards, you use a measurement tool in school. If you could say that she should be at this point of the national standard, then she's not even on the scale yet, you know, as a seven-year-old. So there are things that we're just dealing with that everyday kids, generally in her peers, are miles ahead of her. And the fact is that as she gets older, it's going to get wider and wider and wider.
The gap's going to increase.
The gap's going to increase. And so what we are trying to do is give her as stronger and solid foundation as we can before she experiences anything new, and such as meeting with her dad.
Hmm. Have you ever seen anything like biomedical therapy? Have you ever been looking into these kind of things?
We've been looking at a number of options recently, especially around the support services. For example, we had disability services here recently.
Are they forcing the child to take medication?
No. But it's been suggested, and at this point we're not seriously considering it. Although, at some point it may be required, but we're not hippy greeny natural therapy type people. But at the same time, we believe in the best of both worlds, and so we're looking at different ways to support her through. And medication is a last case scenario for us. I mean, we've talked about Ritalin. I've personally seen good and bad sides of that. If it's managed well and it's looked after, you know, you don't overdo it, you give the right amount and you give it at the right time, everything seems to pan out all right. Last case scenario for us. But you use the tools that are available to you. You use whatever therapies there are available to you, and we'll do what is in her best interests and is the best for the family at the time. Because, again, the day we brought her into our home at 2 years old, 9 kgs, probably no more than 40 centimeters tall, if that, and still wearing infant clothes, you know, this was a very underdeveloped child, to, you know, a sprightly 7-year-old beautiful girl who just loves life. We're still very, very much learning about how her mind is functioning and trying to work on different things to help her to grow and develop as best as we can. Most of her friends we notice at school are up, probably still now, where she's usually in bed 6:30.
Wow. Well, when it comes to medication, I've got a lot of reservations about it. I mean, you take any drug whatsoever, and you give it to a child. Googling side effects of medications and things of that nature is like scary, very just, oh my God, how could you ever give this to a child? But then again, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't dispense medical advice, can I? And the other element behind here is I think that mainstream medicine has been, I don't know, held back in a lot of ways from giving effective treatments. Actually, I think it's actually on record that Rockefeller Medicine has basically dominated the world medical system. You're aware of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm? Yeah? Well, Hippocrates came up with that one, and he also came up with another quote. Let food be thy medicine, and let medicine be thy food. Incidentally, medical schools don't teach doctors nutrition at all.
I don't know, I find that surprising. But, no, she actually does eat very, very well. And we try and keep it as whole foods as possible, but it's... Yeah, when it comes to medication, medication is the last case scenario.
Worst case scenario, yeah.
It's the worst case scenario for us. And while we'll think about it, it's not something that's at the forefront of our minds at this point. And we're just taking a lot of advice. And I have a number of people who are very good close friends of mine who are in the medical profession and whose advice I trust outside of our GP and clinicians. And so when Ritalin was first brought up, it was like, okay, what do you think about it? So, and then it was this whole, nah, too young, you know, let's wait for a couple more years, see how she goes. And then, you know, help her to develop self-coping skills, you know, in her way. And just to give you an example, one of the big things that's happened personally for me is I used to weigh somewhere in excess of 250-odd kilos.
Wow.
And I'm now in the 121 to 122 area. And part of some of my changing of habits was changing how I cope with things. And, you know, I was a very emotional eater. And if something stressed me out, I'd reach for a food, or I'd reach for, you know, something to eat, or even just like a 2-liter bottle of Coke or something, you know, something high sugar. And very sedentary lifestyle. Something stresses me out now, I'm usually, you know, going for a swim at the pools around the corner of my gym that's upstairs at the pools, or walk around the block. You know, or snacking on rice crackers is less guilty than having 10 chocolate chip cookies, you know. So how I cope with things has changed. And so that's what we're trying to teach her, is how she copes with things. Helping her to, even if it's just in kids scribble, because writing coherent words and sentences for her is still very fundamental to her. I mean, writing her name, being able to write her name is a success. And celebrating those little successes, and she loves praise. She doesn't like being growly growled. No kid does, I think. But you know, just helping her to realize that getting things wrong, like if she misspells her name, getting it wrong, that's okay. That's cool. You know, don't get frustrated with it. Carry on. Keep trying. But, yeah, definitely medication is not high on the priority list. But us as a family team, my wife and I are both career educators. So we've got different ways of teaching self-coping skills to her and help her through it.
Is she going to school?
Yeah, she's in a mainstream public school.
Yeah.
And we've actually got a lot of support services around here. She has an excellent resource teacher, an RTLB, they call them here, who has some hours with her. Because of her diagnosis that's been officially confirmed now, she's likely to get some more
assistance
support hours in school, in class hours, you know, with the teacher aid specifically for her in school. And to be honest, special schools have been touted, you know, kids, schools specifically for kids with disabilities, or even like going into a disability unit at another school has been discussed, but it's not something that we're looking at this point seriously, because we wanted to develop friendships, and I'm not going to use the term normal, but I wanted to develop as wide a base of friendships as possible. Those who do have challenges, those who do have disabilities of varying kinds, in the mainstream environment. I don't necessarily agree that it's cotton-wooling her at a special school, but I want her to experience school, you know, that everybody else does.
See, me personally, I'd never want my children to experience school the same way everyone else does, because the majority of adults that I talk to think that school sucked.
It took me a lot of years to realize my mum was right, that I went to school to eat my lunch, you know, and I've actually got the genes to prove it. But she enjoys school. When we went away on holiday, you know, fortunately my in-laws made it possible for us to go to the United States, where my wife is from, and we spent 6 weeks over there, and she absolutely loved it, and we got to play with her cousins and experiencing different things that a lot of kids don't usually do. But that's the kind of things we want for her to be able to experience. We wanted to, you know, she knows the New Zealand national anthem. She gets the words wrong. She gets up and sings the Star Spangled Banner mixed in with God Defend New Zealand. That's quite amusing. And she's the whitest, blondest, blue-eyed girl in the Kapa Haka troop at school. You know, and so those are just the things that we want her to experience, the types of things that will help her to grow that I don't think she would necessarily get in another environment. And that's not to say that special schools, as the term was used with the disabilities advisor the other day, special schools don't offer those types of experiences or even better experiences, I guess, than mainstream schools.
Mm.
We want her to experience school life in a classroom with peers, you know, that she's going to grow up with. I mean, I'm still good friends with people I went to high school with. Even now we talk on occasion and reminisce about the good old days, and whether we like school or not was irrelevant. The fact that we've still got those friendships today is what's most rewarding for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've taken care of autistic boys before, and the times when I've had to pick them up from their special ed classes and things like that, I actually sat in for about 20 minutes one time, and what occurred to me is that these kids weren't really paying attention to the lessons at all. And because there's only two educators in a room full of, say, 20 reasonably severely handicapped children, it wouldn't even be possible for them to teach all of the children at once something anyway, because they need intense one-on-one kind of thing. I mean, like, that was what I was there for to do that one-on-one thing, because you otherwise the attention just kind of like goes out within seconds, and you got to push them back in, You know, it's actually it's such an intense and dare I say emotionally draining job that perhaps and this is just theorizing on my thing, you can't continue to care.
Yeah.
All right. About the progress of the children. Otherwise, you drive yourself emotionally up the wall. All right. Like it becomes an impossible task to accomplish what you want to accomplish, and as a result, you have to switch off the part of you that cares, just so that you can continue to do this job that doesn't work.
Teachers are amazing people. You know, they are really amazing people. Most of 16 years of my education career has been in the tertiary sector, and so you've got adults who tend to display most of the same characteristics. And this is, funnily enough, an argument I had with the teachers' council, because they refused to register me as a teacher to go into a secondary school because my training was tertiary level, and we disagreed on the fact that adults display the same tendencies and the same behavioral problems in general that teenagers in high school do as children in primary school do. Late last year, I did some teacher aiding work at a high school, and just the attention span of the teenagers during a 45-minute class session is all over the place. And we're doing simple reading exercises at level one to help them get additional NCEA level one credits. Doing a little bit of maths, basic like distance table maths, the distance between, say, Auckland and Wellington and so on, and, you know, nothing massively complicated at all. But the attention spans were remarkably short, and so you have to wonder whether or not some form of attention deficit or autistic spectrum. And I guess coming back to our girl, there's been no formal diagnosis of autism, but definitely there is an attention issue. And, you know, having sat in her class and observed, you know, over the last 2 years she's been at school, this is year three for her. Then, you know, you're right. One teacher in a class with 24 students, and you know that your little girl is not the only one who has some form of attention issue, there's going to be times when A, they don't care, and B, the kid doesn't get the attention that they need. I don't fault the teacher for that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an impossible situation. I mean, it's like shoving a soldier into a situation where he's on his own up against 100 other soldiers. You know, you can't blame him for getting shot.
No, absolutely. So that's where we're going to be grateful for additional support hours in the class. We don't expect her to come out, you know, as the most brainiac in the class. It's unfair on her. It's unrealistic on our part. And so we're not expecting her to come out with the highest reading level. I mean, she went up last year. She went up three reading levels, and that was just simply because at nighttime, it's a routine that we have after school. The first 30 minutes is she brings home a reading book. You know, if we can get her to write four or five words, if, and, it, the, you know, then that's good. You know, that's good for us to be able to help her to know that what these words are. And if, you know, we haven't even pushed putting them into a sentence yet. You know, if I am good, you know, I guess you can say your typical teenager's room is what her bedroom looks like, you know, mess everywhere. But just telling her to clean her room is too much. It has to be broken down into the small tasks: shoes in your shoebox, books in your bookshelf, toys in the toy box, but at a single task. So once she's done the first task, you move on to the next one, and you move on to the next one. So,
and through the repetition of this over a period of time, she will learn those lessons and learn how to link those tasks together so that eventually you will be able to say, clean your room, and then she'll equate all of those things.
Yeah.
Two things have occurred to me while you've been speaking is, number one, there was a school in the United States that had a food program change. And I think it was actually a school for, quote, troubled youth. And these children were had some of them like the biological parents of your child, drug abuse problems, parents, and so on and so forth, remarkably difficult to teach. And so what they did is they changed the food that was being served at the cafeteria. They got rid of all the soft drink vending machines and everything out of the school and just gave them healthy, you know, vegetables, fruits, and those kind of things, incredibly healthy diets. And they found that the amount of violence between the students went down dramatically. The amount of attention span of the students, again, went up dramatically. The test scores improved dramatically. So yeah, diet's a huge part of cognitive development as well. If your body has the nutrition that it needs, it can repair itself, it can develop itself very well. And the other thing, there were these twin boys in a school. I forget where the school was. It may have been in Auckland, it may have been in the States, I forget. But the story goes that these two twins were both severely autistic and more or less incapable of communication when they started school. And their educator took specific care with these two kids and tutored them repetitiously, intensely for years and years and years. And they actually wound up becoming quite well educated, made it all the way through seventh form, passing all their exams and everything like that, being able to communicate fully. And that was just because somebody took an active interest. Somebody actually tried to teach them and had the patience to go through that extremely long, drawn-out process of teaching somebody who has a cognitive disability how to do things just over and over and over again. And I believe one of them might have even given a speech at the very end, I think in graduation or something of that nature, fully speaking perfectly. There was nothing wrong with these kids anymore. Everything that was once diagnosed, every disability that was once visible and knowable was gone. And they thanked this teacher profusely for taking that active interest so that they could be, that word that you chose not to use before, normal, like everybody else. And that gives me hope that it is actually possible to reverse all these things. However, again, it takes that intense repetition, schooling, and extraordinary patience upon the educator themselves. And most educators, as you might be well aware, are not the top of the class themselves.
No, definitely not. I mean, I never was the bright spark. I think I walked out of high school with nothing more than, you know, good friends and a good reputation with the teachers. But in terms of academia, no, I didn't even get school C or even vegetable maths for that matter, or cabbage maths as we called it then. But again, I've never believed that qualifications mean that you're good at something. Just proves that you can do something enough to pass a test. And that even, you know, went for when I finished my bachelor's studies a couple of years ago. You know, that was just proved that I was able to given up BS to my professors to make them happy with themselves, I guess, that I was teaching them, that they were teaching me something that, you know, I already knew. But, you know, I've got a lot of hope for our little girl. I really do. As I said, she came to us at 2 years old, 9 kgs. My nephew at 6 months old weighs more than he does. more than she did. She didn't speak. When we put pasta, this little, you know, kid's bowl of pasta in front of her, she was into it with her hands, because we found out previously at her previous caregiver's place, breakfast was corn chips, and it was survival of the fittest when it came to food. And that's just, you know, it was a really sad scenario. We were initially doing respite care, and we put a nappy on her in the morning. We took her back, picked her up later that evening. She was in the same nappy. You know, she'd been in that nappy and been in a porta cot all day, and borderline failure to thrive, as was the diagnosis. And she was under the care of a neurodevelopmental therapist, and she signed off a month and a half after we got this child, saying that she had made enough progress that she was now beyond what she deals with. And she has progressed a significant way from that time when she first came into our home. And so, you know, there's still challenges that she has to and will deal with for the rest of her life. We want her to be, you know, as exposed to as many experiences at this point that are safe for her as possible. And then let her venture out later on. It's not to say that we're going to make all the right decisions, and we'll make all the same bad calls that parents make from time to time. We do that, and I'm learning about how my parents would have felt growing up. They would have made bad calls, and but I always have to look back and say, you know, I was very lucky growing up. I had my parents placed a lot of trust in me. I got away with a lot of stuff, but if I made a wrong decision, there were certainly consequences for my actions. And Ellie's learning, and our girl's learning that too, that there are consequences to bad choices. Usually it involves us confiscating one of her favorite toys for a period of time, and she doesn't like that. So it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of repetition, and just like that basic cleaning her room business, repetition, and daddy's learning patience, which is she knows how to push my buttons, and I've got to remember that. Be calm.
Yeah. Have you noticed that that's actually a problem with a lot of parents, is they forget that they're the adult?
Case in point, right here.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, hold on a second. My child can't boss me around because I'm an adult. I've seen this happen, you know, and this is a problem a lot of parents have, is they try to protect their children so much that they protect their children from the consequences of their own actions. And in so doing, the child doesn't believe that there are consequences to their actions. And when they wind up going out into the world for themselves, it's quite a rude awakening. And they go back to their parents, they go, Mum, Dad, why didn't you teach me that there were consequences for my actions? Well, we were trying to protect you from reality.
My dad rings me up a few years ago, telling me my sister had just come to ask him for a few $100s, and when he told me why, I was like, nah, don't do it. It's because she drove drunk and had the car impounded. And, it wasn't her car. It wasn't her and her partner's car. It was a friend's car, and they were driving it. It was unwarranted, unlicensed, unregistered. She was driving it on a learner's license and was drunk. And the car got impounded, and they were going to sell it in 30 days if she didn't cough up with like $300 or $400. And I was like, no, that's her fault. You taught me hard lessons when I was growing up. This is her turn.
Yeah. I mean, apply it equally, yo.
Apply it equally, you know. And And he did. He actually did it in a different way, in that he gave her some of the money. But after she came up with the bulk of it, you know, you come up with this much, I'll... and, you know, growing up with in a Christian environment, you know, it's that whole saved by grace principle where you do some of the work, I'll make up the difference. And that's a lesson that she actually came to appreciate a little while later on. And now that she's a parent, she's beginning to understand the tough decisions that she has to make.
Yeah.
In her child's best interests, as opposed to what she wants to do now.
Yeah. All right. Well, Wadamu Bayliss is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go to our first hour break now. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you are capable of going to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or set up an automatic payment of a dollar a month or $100 a month or whatever. Whatever you can give is absolutely 100% appreciative. I'm not a collectivist, but however, I'm an individual who's doing the job that the collective needs done for it, and I need the collective to support me in this quest kind of thing. Otherwise, I fall on my ass, and then suddenly New Zealand doesn't have a 5-day-a-week talk show to talk about really important stuff that the mainstream media just won't cover. So thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood doesn't go ahead, make my news. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two with my very special guest, Wadamu Bayliss. And we're talking about raising a child who has fetal alcohol syndrome and the challenges regarding that. And indeed, we're kind of branching out into a lot of different topics surrounding simply raising children with cognitive disabilities and all of that kind of thing. So, Wadamu, welcome back. Now, when we went on break before, you said you had a number of other things that you wanted to outline, so proceed.
I've talked about the type of disempowerment that we've had, if I could use that term, in relation to being home for life parents, the scenarios that we face comparatively to being child, youth and family caregivers in the past and migrating to this home for life situation. One of the big impacts on our family, and I outlined it previously, is the consents that we have to go through or to get just to make the day-to-day decisions for this child in our care. And one of the things I've advocated recently to members of Parliament, in fact, I had a meeting with our two MPs on Tuesday, was to discuss possible changes to legislation that would make it easier on one side to make those decisions independent of needing that parental consent, or that biological parental consent, especially when they're in the best interest of the child, and to be able to make the freedom of those decisions without having to have to worry about it becoming a matter for the courts.
Could you be more specific? Like, who were these MPs, and specifically what kind of amendments were you proposing?
I met with Hamilton West MP Tim McIndoe and Hamilton East MP David Bennett on Tuesday. And what I put before them is a a rather long letter that I had composed over some time. I think, in the end, emailed about 50 MPs version 10 of the document I originally started hammering out one night on my iPad. And one of those was how I believe we should, at some point in our law, be able to terminate, fully terminate, the biological parental rights of a child, to a child, especially in situations where we've got multiple children from the same parents in state care, and there's no long-term prospect of them being returned to that family. This is the situation that we're in. The biological mother is obviously legally incapable of parenting the child. The biological father is, by law, not going to have the child in his custody. And so, yet now, under our current law, their rights are protected. And so while the Care of Children Act, in one of its prime, in one of its principal early on sections, the child's concerns are paramount, or the child's best interests are paramount. Yet it's the parents, the biological parents' rights that are protected. And because of that, they're able to manipulate the lives of the families who actually look after them day to day. What we've talked about as it's sort of a compromise, because that wasn't something that they were willing to look at putting to the minister, was increasing the rights of families such as ours to be able to not have to worry about domestic travel being a consent issue, the school that she goes to being a consent issue, or the fact that we go to church winding up in the courts, you know, being able to be manipulated in that way, of just being able to live life, you know, without the worry of a court scenario hanging over our heads. Okay, the wider issue of access may end up being a court issue in the future, again, but, you know, being able to go on holiday down the South Island without having to ring up people who are disengaged from the raising of this child, either by choice or by law, you know, is a freedom that we want, and that's not currently available to us in law, nor is it really available to us in any of the amendments that have been, or the law that's being proposed in this vulnerable children bill that's in the House now.
My perspective, I mean, I've interviewed a number of people who have had children in SIFS care, and on the negative side of the spectrum, and there's lots of these kind of cases, what occurs to me is that good parents wind up getting their children taken off them, whereas bad parents wind up having their children kept and indeed under their control. And it's almost like there's actually an agenda to destroy children's lives using the law as a weapon, rather than being able to enrich people's lives using the law as a tool.
Yep, absolutely. I totally understand the negativity that is out there, with especially with child, youth, and family. And when I use the term, I grew up in the system. My mum was a social worker. For my formative years as a young boy, growing up, until she retired when I was 23. I went to school with a lot of the kids on her caseload, and quite frankly, they were humbugs. But a lot of them also had gone from place to place to place and had very unsettled formative years. And I think if they had some form of stability, whether it was with their biological family or whether it was with another family that was able to look after them long term, I think if they had some kind of stability, then the issues facing them later on, and in some cases still facing them now, probably would have been negated. I worked with a young father whose wife actually attempted to do some damage to their child. And the child was taken from them and placed into SIPS care. I saw him go through the process, him and his wife then at the time go through the process of restoration of trust between them and the child, and in the state getting to a point where that child was actually put back into their care. Now, those types of scenarios are not the ones I'm concerned about, because there are those families who have momentary blips, they have the problems, they want to deal with them, and they're going to get the child back. There are those who, and I spoke about this grandfather earlier on, you know, there are those families who have false accusations thrown at them, and SIPS in a very reactive way just comes in and yanks the kid. It's not, I don't think that's in the best interest. I remember accompanying my mum, I was 16 years of age at the time, I remember accompanying my mother to a report that there was a child, there was a child at least that she knew of, in this house where there were drug deals going down, likely drug use being done at the time, and there were four police cars, herself being the duty social worker and two others, and I was her driver. I drove her to the location. The house was completely sealed up, and they basically shut all the windows, shut all the doors, and what I couldn't really believe was they had taped the windows, basically so there was no vent, there was no air flow through the windows at all. And they had been bonging it up and doping it up, and in one of the side rooms that was completely filled with smoke were these two babies. One was already blue, and the other one, you know, it's the reason why, as a teenager and even as an adult, I've never drunk and never done drugs, not only because of my religious beliefs. I've seen what it can do firsthand, and I never wanted to be involved in that kind of stuff, especially if it can harm another human being. But I've never seen my mum as devastated that night as it was crazy, and she reflected on it a number of times. And so, you know, there are people who, you know, even in that situation, under our current law, which didn't exist at that time, under our current law, those biological parents would still retain the controlling interest in those children's lives, even under SIPS care. And I think most of us would agree that under those extreme circumstances, they shouldn't have any rights to that child. You know, they've basically shot themselves in the foot, and they might as well shoot themselves in the head. And I make no apologies if that sounds harsh, but you've got to stop being selfish at some point when you've had a hand in bringing another child into the world. And you know, I've made my fair share of selfish decisions in my life, and you know, I'm man enough to admit it. But I think the best decision I could make, if I'm not going to take responsibility for that little life that I helped create, then let somebody do it under full law and let that child be adopted. You know, and cool, you know, move on. But don't let them languish in a system that really isn't going to help them. The only reason that we believe our daughter has progressed as much as she has, and I don't make an apology for calling her my daughter, is because we've invested the time into her. And, you know, I don't consider myself a saint by any means, but for goodness sakes, if that if those biological parents aren't going to take responsibility for her, it's not the state's job. It's, you know, let somebody else do it. And that currently is an impossible situation because, again, the power rests with the biologicals. We can't go to the court and say, look, she's been under our roof for 7 years. Let us adopt her. The biologicals still have to give consent. And I'm not certainly not advocating a return to the dark old days of adoption, when babies were whisked away and, you know, all that kind of stuff. For me personally, it's important that she knows her history. It's important that she knows her story. And where that's possible to give it, we're certainly going to give it. We know that she has three half-siblings. There's a fourth possibly that even the mother's pretty foggy on. She's not even 100% sure that there is an older child. There's a suspicion that there is. We don't know. Just 2 weeks ago, we rang up the biological mum on a phone that we've specifically designated for contact purposes. She told us that she was in Wellington, but couldn't tell us exactly where because she wasn't sure. And so, you know, that's just to give you an idea of the kind of people we deal with. And I really hate to say this, but we're saved from a lot of these potential court issues by the fact that we're not dealing with the brightest match in the box. You know, and unfortunately, there are others in the same situation we are who are dealing with more manipulative people, and have been doing it for a lot longer than we have. So what I advocated and what I, and to some degree what I'm still advocating is that at some point in our law, New Zealand should be able to, or people should be able to have their parental rights terminated and that child be placed up for adoption. And the measure, I guess, for that would need to be high. I guess one of the measures would be that there's no long-term prospect for this child to go back to their biological family, whether that's parents or grandparents or an uncle, an auntie, you know, somebody who's reasonably capable of being a parent to that child.
What you're talking about here is about just introducing something that the law doesn't currently have: reason, logic, and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the child needs to be thought of. And more than the grown-up, and we talked about it before, that the grown-up, you know, you need to realize, talk about patience, I need to be realized that I'm the grown-up and she's the child. And more often than not, she's a child being a child, you know, who wasn't, you know, stubborn and answered back to their parents at some point. And again, seven-year-old with intellectual disability and other cognitive difficulties, she's still learning right from wrong, and its rudiments, you know, that crossing the street without looking left, without looking right, could be hazardous to her health is something she's still working on at 7 years old. So that, I mean, that may give a bit more of an idea of the type of difficulties that we're working with to try and help her just be safe. Stranger danger is still a foreign concept. And just to give you an example, I said we spent a few weeks over in the States. On our layover in Los Angeles, she actually went and talked to this man and his son over by the gate where we were going to board our plane. And so I was over there. Our plane was there. It was getting, you know, prepped for the next flight. And so we looked at the plane, and that's the plane we're going to get on. And she was still talking to this guy, and he looked vaguely familiar to me. I recognized him from somewhere. Just couldn't picture where from. And the face in my head and the name just weren't weren't meshing.
It wasn't Jimmy Savile, was it?
No, it wasn't Jimmy Savile.
I'm just joking.
No, but 48 hours later, I was looking at my iPad and looking at Facebook, and this guy's face appeared, and one of my friends had linked the thing. It was Eddie Izzard. And he actually came up to me when we arrived in Las Vegas and says to me, "That girl is so beautiful. She's so loving. She's so friendly. You look after that girl, and she's going to have a tremendous life." And, you know, that was so complimentary from a stranger. And yet at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm going, you could have been an axe murderer, and she would have had the same conversation with you, and you would have had malicious intent. And so, you know, while that situation is good, she'd go up to anybody in the park and just be so trusting and so open that not really realizing the potential, you know, the stranger danger aspect that, you know, don't go up to strangers, don't accept candy from strangers kind of thing. And so those simple things are things that we're trying to instill in her, that most parents don't have to struggle with. But I guess it's pretty common with those who do have to deal with children with disabilities or
Well, it's about decision making and reasoning processes that simply don't exist. They're just not there. And so, you know, you can sometimes. I mean, I've got mates, and their child's really, really perceptive, and what have you. And they, I don't know. It's almost like the kids know who's a good person and who's not by instinct. It's really, really odd. Like, I'll see somebody who looks kind of dodgy, and the child will look at them and go, that guy looks kind of dodgy, you know, like they're kind of like right up there. Whereas I don't think if you don't have that perception, you can wind up getting into, as you say, a lot of trouble with that stranger danger element. Which means more or less constant supervision, which is a lot of, shall we say, intense responsibility on the people who are raising that, something that's probably not within the realm of possibility for somebody who has an enormous addiction problem and somebody who's a convicted child sex offender.
Yeah. And we went out of our way a couple of years ago to actually go and meet the biological father. We arranged the time to meet in his town, and we went and spent the weekend down there, stayed with some friends of ours in the town, and it was just myself, my wife, met up with him and his partner, and they had two kids, and have two kids, and we just said, no kids, you know, Ellie's going to stay where she is, and our girl's going to stay where she is, and your kids can go wherever, and the grown-ups will just meet. And so, you know, we sat down and met with him. It was the first time we'd met with him. And we discussed, you know, we'd like to adopt her. We'd like to have your blessing to do it. We'll maintain contact, you know, as she grows. And the conversation from his side of things was, well, you know, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine. It actually reminded me of that Finding Nemo, the seagulls, you know, mine, 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 mine. But yet at that time it was, 6 years she'd been on Earth, and you hadn't tried to make contact, despite, you know, his, what did he say, that he had never, he didn't know she was in care, that she, you know, she should meet me, blah, blah, blah. It was all about him. And in a very funny way, even though that the mother and the father have actually never been together since the one night stand, really, how similar they are. And, you know, it's funny that both their names start with M. But the commonality between them and how they act in terms of the child being a possession was really surprising to me. And again, both of them very possessive in terms of mine, 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 yet neither of them are really capable of ownership. And when I say ownership, I mean responsibility for this child. And it's in those scenarios, you know, and I guess a few more tougher tests to determine whether or not their parental rights at some point should be removed and we should be allowed to adopt this child.
The term slippery slope comes to mind. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a conspiracy theorist. You know, I'm quite proud of it. And
wouldn't have guessed with your intro.
Yeah. And what I've found out over a number of years of study and interviewing basically copious quantities of people who've dealt with SIFS care and things of that nature is that there's an agenda to destroy the family unit. Right, a global agenda to destroy the family unit. And this has become really, really powerful, I think. We've now got, 50%+ divorce rate? And you have a look at the stats on young boys that don't have their father in their life for all or most of their life, and they're something like seven times more likely to get a criminal conviction. And then on the other side of the fence, you have CPS in the United States, Child Protective Services, where children are nine times more likely to be sexually abused within Child Protective Services care. And when we look at legislation and having the state have the ability to make decisions for families rather than those families being able to make those decisions for themselves, it means that the state becomes all powerful. Now, it reminds me of so many examples throughout history where the dear leader of the country becomes a de facto parent for children. They get forcibly put into government indoctrination programs called public schools. And if anything, what it does is it prevents parents from having control over how their children are raised and how their thinking functions and what have you happen, because it becomes down to the point where you can't earn enough money in enough hours of the day so that you can spend a quantitative amount of time with your child, teaching them everything they need to know on a daily basis in order to get through life. So you're forced, therefore, in order to give your child into the care of the state for a certain number of hours a day. And in so doing, the state has direct access to your child's mind for the majority of their life, more or less. And I think this is actually quite dangerous. But that said, when we're dealing with a case like yours, I think you're probably right. There should be some kind of apparatus or framework by which a reasonable decision can be made in order to take destructive, possessive parents out of the equation, perhaps, and leave them with people who have proven themselves time and time again to be really good for the child. I mean, it's like, what decision has to be made, who is going to be putting this legislation into place? And the thing is, that aside, what's actually best for the child, and who gets to decide that if not the parents? Yep. You know, that's the tipping point. That's the troubled waters in which we are taking this vessel into. And myself knowing that there's some form of almost like a child psych warfare going on in high schools and whatnot, this is particularly poignant in the United States, where children are being asked to give surveys on what their parents do at home and then give it to their teachers so that they can put it on record. What kind of drugs do mummy and daddy have in the cupboard? How many guns do they have? You know, these kind of things. The state really has no right or anything to do with your business at home. But at the same time, when we've got this kind of mediation process going on, it's actually untenable and unsustainable, this situation that you're suffering through right now. You can't go on like this forever, can you? And that's probably the reason why you actually want to do something about it. That's probably the reason why you want to change the legislation around this, so that other families that might be in a similar situation to you actually have a legal framework with which to resolve these issues in a very reasonable and perfectly safe kind of way, without the abuse of the state or the abuse of their parents revisited on the child.
Yep. See, we have less protections now as a home for life, as home for life parents, than we did as SIF caregivers. As a SIF caregiver, we had a social worker assigned to the child. We also had a support social worker assigned to us as a couple who were there to support us. If the mother, for example, who was the most consistent one, in fact, she was the only one until we underwent home for life proceedings in 2010, wanted a supervised access visit, she'd go to the SIPS office or contact the social worker, however she did it, and they would contact us, arrange a time, they would arrange a place, a neutral location, usually the Salvation Army center in town. They would arrange a neutral person to oversee the access, so we could go, we could go off for an hour. And she'd be supervised, she'd be safe. And that person who they would assign would report back to Child, Youth and Family about what happened at the visit. We got a stipend from Child, Youth and Family. Not relevant.
Hold on, what's a stipend? I don't know.
We got an allowance from Child, Youth and Family.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Just to cover board and, basic necessities and things like that. So we weren't paid for it. Basically, they paid us a board, an allowance, and all caregivers get it.
You weren't given a lump sum when you first took on the child?
No. We got nothing. We bought a bed. In fact, we actually had, in the hopes of having our own children, we had a cot stowed away, which we assembled, and we had a lot of things already in place because we wanted to be parents. But because of my, I guess you could say, my excess baggage, that wasn't happening. So things we had in place already were really good. I mean, we used the quarterly clothing allowance that Child, Youth and Family gave us. We sent it to my mother-in-law in America because the seasons were, they're coming out of winter when we're going into summer. The sales were going on, and so we got copious amounts of clothes that would last you a lot longer than stuff you can buy at the warehouse and for a lot more value for money from the States. Got sent over, and, grandma being grandma was excited just to send stuff anyway. And so we utilized the funds that we got from them in her best interests. But if things went to court, again, we were covered. We didn't have to think about, how are we going to pay for this? How are we going to deal with the legal aid or the legal cases? Because Child, Youth and Family basically were the ones that were being taken to court instead of us. Whereas now, as Home for Life parents, it's us.
Sounds more like life imprisonment.
Well, look, this scenario last year with when the father tried to get supervised access visits, he actually served us, not Child, Youth and Family, because we're the ones with custody. But Child, Youth and Family wouldn't even come to the party. She's not our child, basically. She's not under us. She's not one of our children in the system. And so that's that's something that we had to deal with. Well, the biological parents both qualify for legal aid. They get this stuff sorted under legal aid. We basically funded ourselves, unless, which was the case, our Hamilton West MP, Tim McIndoe, advocated on our behalf, and we managed to get something out of Child, Youth and Family because of historical cock-ups.
Would you say that the deck is kind of stacked against you in this case?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Because, again, any legal matters are against us. You know, it's us personally, as opposed to, you know, previously as caregivers, as child, youth, and family caregivers, custody is with the chief, under the chief executive, under the umbrella of the chief executive. And so any service that is done is done against child, youth, and family and the basically their unlimited checkbook, as opposed to, you know, we live life on a budget, you know, just like any other family does.
Well, you know what occurs to me there is that the deck is stacked against one person on one side of the spectrum and it's stacked against the other on the other side of the spectrum. It used to be the stack was it was stacked against the parents, and now it's stacked against you.
And for being a parent to a child whose parents can't do their job, you know, for us it's let's put it this way. If you look at it just from a financial perspective, we get an unsupported child benefit every week for this girl. And should we adopt her, which we hope to do this year with the consent of the mother, we'll lose that. We don't care. You know, it's financially, it's not the issue. Money is not the issue. For us, it's the full and the full protection of law, and also the full rights and the full privileges and the ability to exercise our rights as parents, because we're held fully responsible for what happens to this child, but we don't have any of the rights and protections that parents get. Again, just the fact that a grown adult has to ask let's put it this way. A grown, relatively mature adult has to ask the permission of a younger, not so mature drug addict and a convicted sex offender on one side, you know, the permission to go to Wellington or to go up north for the week, or, you know, go down south for a week. You know, we have to just get those types of silly things.
Well, you know, I mean, nothing makes for better, more streamlined decision making than having to have the approval stamp from drug addicts and sex offenders. You know, I mean, I can't imagine a more perfect system.
Well, here's another situation. We were asked last year if we would be interested in taking in another child. This is from a friend whose sister-in-law had a baby. The mum is in and out of the mental health facility here adjacent to Waikato Hospital. So if anybody knows Waikato Hospital, they know exactly what I'm talking about. It's called the Henry Bennett Center. And the father is in and out of prison. In fact, I think he's there now. For beating up the mother repeatedly. And the mum keeps going back. And so this little baby was taken into care a matter of hours after birth. Not the first child in care. I think it was the fourth. My darling's over there. Let's call it third. Third child. And again, this is the kind of situation that doesn't exist in our neighbor's country. You know, in Australia, if you've got multiple children that go into care, bang, you lose all rights.
They try and support you while pregnant.
I mean, they try and support you while you're pregnant. If the problem can be solved, cool. If not, there is a termination point. Okay? But it's very quick. So if you've got a child that's taken off you at birth and it's not your first situation like that, and you know, that's it, done. You know, and the same in other cases. I mean, if you want to cite the states and whether you like the states or not is irrelevant. The fact that the same scenario exists, this is not your first party, this is not your first child taken off you, and you're not doing anything to sort your stuff out. Gone. That child is gone, and it's adopted. They become adoptable, and they're given at least a chance to have a foundation start. you know. Now, what happens after that, you know, you talked about divorce rates. Stuff's going to happen, and families are going to dissipate. And but you try your best, and it's up to the couples to make it work. But at least the child is given an opportunity that if they're just left in that scenario, if they're left in that I guess, never-ending cycle, if the biological parents aren't capable of breaking that cycle for them, then maybe the child should be put into another position and be given an opportunity that they probably would never have had if things stayed where they were.
Well, I mean, voluntary participation I'm actually a hell of a lot more in favor of, where people will actually step up and say, I'll protect this child, I'll provide for this child, I've got X amount of qualifications, I've got such and such a stable family home. You know, it seems pretty straightforward, right? Mm-hmm. But again, what occurs to me here is that if you're doing the right thing and what have you, they try to make your life harder, and if you're doing the wrong thing, they're just trying to make your life easier. You know, I mean, like, this is one of those kind of things that happens off to the side. However, it happens a hell of a lot more often than people might think. And so doing, it's actually doing a huge quantity of damage to children in a society, which means that when they grow up, they will grow up as damaged adults. And I would like to see the statistics on this, but I'm not. This is just my postulation, based upon this. Whether or not children that are in state care and whatnot are far more likely to wind up going to jail, all right? Because I've seen so many cases where children are ripped away from their families. It's called breaking the bond. Mm-hmm. As the Jesuits said, you give me a child until the age of 7 and I will give you the adult, or words to that effect. If you are transitioning around to various different environments, different state homes and things of that nature, during those formative years, you permanently destroy that child's ability, in many cases, to be a functioning adult. And once you become an adult, nobody else is any longer responsible for you. You have to be responsible for yourself. And if you were raised irresponsibly, well, guess what's going to happen? You're going to wind up getting frickin' incarcerated. And who are you going to be incarcerated with? A whole bunch of people that are in the exact same situation. And the cycle continues, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and it's in part the patience shown by the caregivers to be in there for the long haul, and that's something that when the first social worker we dealt with, that's something that we said that we're in for the long haul, and that's why we're still here, 7 years on, 6-7 years on, and that's. Despite the different situations and the different trials that my wife and I have been through, the one thing that we've both remained constant with, is her best interests. It's always been about her, and we've made bad calls along the way, but it's we're human, But there's one thing about admitting your mistakes. And making changes to get yourselves back into a position where you're focused, you're determined, you're dedicated. And that's the situation that we've found ourselves in. And with her diagnosis recently of intellectual disability, I've been looking for full-time work, for probably close to 2 years or more now, so that both of us can work towards goals of getting out of debt and, making some moves that are going to help benefit our family in the long run. And we actually came out of the meeting deciding that that's actually not in the best interests of our family. And so when I say I work as a life coach, I've started to work from home, so that if I'm needed at our daughter's school, or there's other, like, for example, medical appointments that have been a lot lately. There have been a lot of them lately. Or there's support that she needs at school. There's other things that need happening around home. I'm available. You know, I can tailor my schedule to that. But having us both work in full-time scenarios is just not in her best interest and in our best interest at the time. Sure, financially it would benefit us greatly. It'd be awesome. But like I said about the financial support that we got from Child, Youth and Family and the benefit that we get from Work and Income Now, that's not the driving force behind what I do and what we do. You know, the money, cool, would help. But we need to be there to support her, and that's the full focus of what we want to do and to make sure that she's got that foundation that she needs.
Well, it seems that there's an old saying, the most important thing you can spend on your children is time.
Time.
You know? And this is another part. Raising kids has gotten harder and harder and harder. It's always been hard, all right? In fact, it would probably, to a degree, it was probably harder back in the day because people had maybe 10 times as much fertility as we do today because we've all got all these artificial sweeteners in the food supply and GMO food and fluoride in the water and blah, 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 blah. All of these things are just taking fertility. It's dropping like a stone, more or less, and there's statistics to prove all of this. Now, the problem here is back in the day, like when my father had our family, I'm the youngest of five. He was able to support and raise five children on one income, and we were able to take holidays in the summer and things of that nature. That's not frickin' possible anymore. All right, unless perhaps born into privilege. It's actually becoming statistically unlikely, and even more unlikely by the day, to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I look back on a time prior to having our young girl in our house. My wife and I were probably pulling in somewhere around the region of 130,000 combined income a year. And we were refused mortgages on more than one occasion. And this was before recession. This is before this land value issue and, you know, quite gratefully so now, actually, I can look back on it and saying, blessing in disguise. We're actually, you know, getting by on what my wife earns and what little I bring in just helps supplement that. I mean, we're able to put a little bit aside every now and then, and I've got friends who are coming up for the Ironman in Taupo this weekend, and it gives us a chance to go down and, you know, be the cheering squad and, you know, all these types of things. And, you know, every now and then we go have a weekend away, or even sometimes it's just going out as a family to a movie, or even just going to rent a movie and get a couple of little microwave bags of popcorn, and that's a treat, you know. So those little things are really cool to be able to do, and we don't need two full-time incomes to do that. But as you said, you know, the best thing I can invest into this little girl's time, and the best thing we can invest into this little girl is time. But I guess on the other side of it is, you know, no other success. This is another maxim that that I learned through church, and I really believe is that no other success can compensate for failure in the home.
I got another thing to tell you here. Firstly, about microwave popcorn. Did you know that Soviet Russia outlawed microwaves in the 70s, classified them as a public health risk?
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, under occupied, I think it was under occupied Finland or Norway, behind the Iron Curtain or something like that. They did a study on university students, and they were like, you know what? Let's see what happens. Let's get 10 university students and let's give them microwave food every meal of the day. They had to stop it on like day 10 or 11 or something like that because every single student was beginning to show signs of adult onset leukemia. So Russia went, yeah, let's ban them.
but they put nuclear reactors in their microwaves. We all know how Chernobyl worked out. But, I guess I just talk in the wider variety in terms of treats. You get the whole fizzy drink business and all this stuff going on. For us, I put that in the category of treats, and those are, I guess the PC world has even overtaken Sesame Street, and Cookie Monster is not so much Cookie Monster anymore as it used to be, scoffing cookies, but...
Broccoli, you know, Monster now.
Yeah, he's, cookies are a sometime food, and there are some treats which we have in our home, which, you know, for example, I might buy one big bottle of fizz every other week, and that lasts, you know, a few days, and so she gets to experience, you know, different things and different foods as well. Her lunchbox isn't stacked to the brim with preservative-laden food. And it's, you know, make her fresh sandwiches every day, and she has fruit and, you know, variety in her lunchbox. And so and her dinners are usually I make them here. In fact, tomorrow, just to give you an idea, tomorrow night I've got pumpkin, you know, little round pumpkins which I'm hollowing out and going to put meat in them and bake them, and you know, that's so, you know, with lots of veggies and a bit of meat, and you know, I just try and experiment with it, and the idea is that she can scoop her food out of this whole pumpkin and eat the pumpkin as well. So fresh garden stuff, it's awesome. It's not hard to do, and really it's not expensive. I priced it out that this meal for the three of us is going to cost $12.
Yeah, well, that's pretty spot on.
Yeah. So, and it's all whole foods, hot, you know, broccoli and a little bit of mincemeat and onions and spinach, and but baked in this pumpkin. And so you got all your variety, and then I usually, you know, try and give her at least two or three bits of fruit in a day, and so she gets her 5+.
here's another bad piece of news for you. Did you know that because of industrial agriculture, there's supposed to be something like 50 trace elements that are available in the soil in order for food to actually develop the nutrients, properly?
Yeah.
There are now about 3 of, yeah, of those elements left in the soil because of intensive farming practices. And California recently did a study on this about the nutritional value of their fruit and vegetables and so on and so forth. And they amended the 5+ a day in California to 10+ a day.
I've kind of looked at the 5+ as it's at least 5+, but it's one of those things where the food pyramid's kind of gone upside down and left to right, and you know, I don't exactly hold on to the.
Here's another funny thing about the food pyramid. A nutritionist went to a cattle farmer in the United States, and he showed them the current FDA approved food pyramid, and he goes, "Does this look familiar to you?" And the farmer looks at it and he goes, "Yeah, that's about the same diet we give our cows when we fatten them up for the slaughter."
Yeah, it's crazy how much damage we're doing to ourselves when we just don't pay attention. I mean, to things. You know, I don't spend copious amounts of hours looking at the, you know, I guess the nutritional panel on the back of a product, and but I do, especially when we planted our own garden. We knew the soil was deficient in a number of things, and we know in general that one of the big minerals that we need is magnesium.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is very deficient in our soils.
And selenium too, deficient.
Selenium too. Mm. Funnily enough, those are some chemicals that we produce naturally in our own bodies. But in a child that's got developmental problems, issues, concerns that our girl has, those are the chemicals that help balance her out the most. And so those are the things that, while we don't give her a full-on multivitamin regime to help supplement it, we do provide her some form of, I guess, non-industrial strength vitamins but ones that are going to help her at least supplement what she produces, I guess boost what she produces a little more. But it's through natural supplements. One of the things that she does not produce, and this is common with fetal alcohol syndrome kids, is melatonin. And so we've found a supplement which we actually get from the States, which helps her just get over the barrier of not going to sleep, because it would be, having struggled early on, it wouldn't be uncommon for her to be awake now. And I mean not sleepy awake, I mean full on awake. And so we know that about 5:30, 6 o'clock, she's starting to naturally feel tired, and 0.5 of a milligram is all we give her. The tablet is a 1 milligram chewable tablet, just like our old vitamin C tablets we used to chew on and suck on like lollies years ago. So we give her half of one of those a night, and it, within a half an hour she's snoring, asleep, and on average about 10 hours sleep a night.
Probably a lot more effective and less damaging than giving her sleeping pills.
Exactly. Which some parents do. And the thing is, it's melatonin. The only ingredient in the pill is melatonin. Outside of the stuff that keeps it in its pill form. And that's okay, because that's a natural biodegradable consumable anyway. But, it's one of those things that just helps her get over the thing, that helps her body to grow and helps her body to develop. And I've got no problems with, I don't consider that in the same league as Ritalin. I don't put that in the same league as Ritalin. It's not doing her body any harm. Like excess vitamin C, you get rid of it. Your body naturally disposes of excess vitamin C.
Interesting fact about vitamin C: it's the only medication, or rather treatment, that has no known toxic dose, which is not even true of water.
If you drink too much water, you can actually make yourself sick.
Yeah.
Or die.
Yeah. A study performed in the States where they gave several pounds of vitamin C directly infused into the bloodstream over a number of years with no noticeable side effects. I thought that was quite amazing.
No, I mean, I have a multivitamin regime. I just take a 1 multivitamin a day. It helps me. I have regular medical checks just for my own sanity, and just to make sure that what I'm doing in terms of my diet, having come down from such a high place, is not doing me medically any harm. It's quite a ways to come down, some 135 kilos, and if you do it wrong, it could cause you more damage than good. I didn't have any conditions prior to this weight loss starting, so I wasn't diabetic or even pre-diabetic. Didn't have any cholesterol or blood sugar issues. Basically, I was healthy. I was just extremely fat. In fact, I was in my own category of super morbid obesity. I felt really special. Not. Just making sure that the supplements that we, well, the things that we don't get naturally from our fresh fruit and veg, are being provided for. And I have to say that, whether you like multivitamins or not, for me, they're working. My bloods are where they should be, and all those important elements are where they should be.
There's an old saying, you can't argue with results.
No, you can't. And
it doesn't stop some people from trying, particularly medical doctors. Don't take the multivitamins, they don't do anything. Here, have this incredibly dangerous drug with 700 different side effects, including killing yourself and your family in the bathtub.
it's funny, talking to people about multivitamins, as I was the other day, I says, you just got to be careful about what multivitamin you do have. Some people some people's bodies absorb particular vitamins easier than others. We all know that we can't absorb more than a certain amount of VC a day. The body just naturally gets rid of it.
American GIs in Vietnam know exactly how much VC they weren't allowed to consume in a day.
Vitamin C, I should say, not Viet Cong.
apparently napalm's good for the skin.
Boom.
We can come to a break now if you want to quickly finish your point, and we'll run off on that note, you know, on that high and freebie note, you know, ladies and gentlemen.
Where you went with that one, man. But no, it's just being careful. I mean, for us, it's about making sure that basically what we consume in our home isn't going to do us damage, and it's more important for our little one to make sure that she's got healthy food. She's drinking good milk. That, you know, and really, I don't care whether it's a light-proof bottle or not. Milk. It's from a cow, you know, as long as it's milk from a cow. Milk that we trust, it's not going to make you sick, you know, ultimately.
Allegedly. I've become lactose intolerant, which really sucks because I actually really did enjoy milk in my coffee back in the day, but now I have to have black coffee. I get sick as a dog if I have milk. Unless it's actually fresh from the cow, hasn't been pasteurized, hasn't been homogenized, hasn't been, you know, like, basically what happens is pasteurization and homogenization, all it does is destroy all the possible nutrients that your body could get out of that milk in order to make sure that it's safe. So it's like drinking nothing.
We want to go visit my uncle's farm in Turangi so she can naturally see, you know, drink straight milk, because it's been a long time since I've done it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do agree. Some of the processing takes a lot of the good stuff out. Mm. And, you know, that whole, you know, why go buy a calcium-rich milk, you know, the yellow top stuff at the shop, when you can just go get it straight from the cow and, like, it's got everything there, including the cream.
Yeah, that stuff is good. All right, we're going to go to break, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after that one with my very special guest, Whitamu Bayliss. Back in the tick. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number 3 of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. You know, the lovely little island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, where the Fukushima radiation is so good that sunbathers are enjoying soaking up the rays. And Whitamu Bayliss is my guest. When he moves house, he doesn't just move house, he Whitta moves house.
It's worse.
Yeah, see, there is a value in having lame jokes. I know
two down here is bad talkback jokes.
Yeah. I'm probably the king of bad talkback jokes. Not the king of talkback, but just bad jokes.
No, I actually talked to the other king of talkback this morning, funnily enough.
Who's the other alleged king of talkback?
Mr. Smith from News Talk.
Oh, Leighton.
Yeah, I spoke to him this morning. He just put something out there about life-changing events, and so I explained to him some of the changes that I'd been making, and he was a bit stunned.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to bag him because I don't really know the guy. It's just the name Leighton just reminds me of somebody with latent homosexuality. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, some of our conversation, latent pedophilia.
All right. I'm sure he'll be chuffed about that mention. Yeah. In fact, here's another lame joke for you. A bass drum, a thimble, and a cymbal fell off a cliff. Ba-dum-tsh.
Okay. Moving right along.
Or would a moving right along?
Oh. Please.
Okay. I'll stop.
Next question.
I can't actually stop. You know, I'm just freaking relentless. Okay. All right. So, we've discussed nutrition. We've discussed the legal system. We've discussed some of the failings of child, youth, and family services, and also the failure of trying to actually get through to the legislators about instances like this. They have it's like there's a block. Would you agree that they have these kind of I don't know, loyalties to the status quo? Do you reckon?
I guess the status quo, yes, but also. I really hate to quote some movies, but I don't know if you've seen the movie White House Down with Jamie Foxx and Channing Tatum, where the Jamie Foxx character and Channing Tatum are talking about, you know, how he wants to do something presidential, he wants to do something that makes a difference, and he makes the comment almost in passing that, you know, when you become president, after that it's about being re-elected. And so it's popularity politics kind of thing.
You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of what somebody said about the media. In fact, it was Ian Wishart. I was on his show last week, I think. And we were talking about the failing in the media to cover important issues. And one of the points that we raised was that in an effort to get advertisers, public support, popular support, and what have you, the only way to do that in terms of accessing the entirety of the population base is to appeal predominantly to the lowest common denominator. I would think that it's not entirely different with politics.
No, I don't think so either. As I was mentioning before, I had met with the two MPs this week, and one of them was quite clear in his view that what I was proposing in terms of the full termination of parental rights being put into legislation wasn't politically popular and not likely to go anywhere. And it's obviously something that I've thought about a lot. And no, it's not popular. It definitely isn't. It's controversial. It's not something that I've come to the conclusion of lightly either. It's not something I've just pulled out of the top of my head and say, hey, let's do this. You know, and obviously there's a lot. I think there should be a lot of tests to get there, but there should be a measure. It should be an avenue where the possibility at least exists and should be considered.
Yeah. As
opposed to no. Because as it goes now, our daughter is in our care until she's 16, 17 years of age, and at that time she's legally able to make her own decisions. And you know, that's cool. You know, she can make her own decisions as she grows up. That's the kind of parents that we aim to be. You know, we'll give her the same kind of restrictions our parents did. But, you know, legally, at 16, 17, she's able to leave and be independent under the current law. But until, you know, until that time, she actually doesn't have the full backing and protection of the law behind her as much as we don't have it behind us. We're held fully accountable for her day-to-day care and for her day-to-day welfare. And yet, again, I come back to that point, we're not able to make the day-to-day decisions that parents generally can.
Does this mean if you slip up once, even a minor amount, the parents, her biological parents, could use that kind of like as a weapon or something of that nature to take her off you?
Possibly. Well, take her off us, and you know, again, child, youth, and family would come into play in terms of she would go into the care of another. You know, should go back to being a child, youth, and family child.
So even if the child let's say for the sake of hypothetically, you and your missus weren't very good at it whatsoever, and she wouldn't wind up going back to her parents at all. She'd just wind up going into state care. So you can't win if you try in this world.
No, well, we lose out from failing the child. And that's the kind of conscience that we have. But the child loses out. The child loses out going from place to place to place. Now, I mean, you count the number of children who have been in our system and you know, who have bounced around the system, various caregiving scenarios, various caregiver placements. You know, each has their own unique way of doing things. And just like being a parent, there's no one right way. You know, Dr. Spock can write all the books he wants, but just because he does it doesn't mean it works. You know, Jeff doesn't work for all services, surfaces, you know. And so the child loses out in that situation. If we screw up, we've screwed the child up. And we've, for us, you know, we've invested time, we've invested emotion. And that's the stuff that's going to pay off for us in the long run, is the child's going to benefit from that investment. It's not the monetary aspect of things that, you know, that she buys, you know, the toys that she plays with. In fact, most of the toys that she has in her room have an educational aspect to it because they're helping her to understand either her place in our family or enhance her ability to learn. She's got, you know, cards and puzzles that help her to just learn how to count, you know, and identify a picture with a word, you know, dog on half a card, a picture of a dog on the other. So it's a matching word to picture, you know, type elements. Even just the cognitive, the physical cognition aspects of her life. You know, the best resource we had for her there was a Mr. Potato Head. You know, it might sound really, really simple, but being able to put things into holes and being able to make sure that, you know, it's the right thing to go in that right hole. You know, you obviously don't put an arm in a nose slot, you know, and you don't put lips in the ears. You know, making just helping her understand that things go in particular places. And that's not to say that, you know, we just, hey, make the craziest potato that you can. You know, it's fun little games that she enjoys playing that help her to learn and develop, and that's part of that repetition thing. But again, if we screw up and she starts bouncing around the system, you know, we've failed. We have failed. You know, you can't put any other way on it. That's a failure on our part.
I think children are different to adults in that way, is that the children are dependent on whoever's the caregiver, more or less. So the caregiver messes up, the kid gets messed up. The kid can't mess themselves up. It's always the fault of the caregiver. It's always the fault of the parents. The child virtually doesn't even have a choice. I mean, did you have a choice about which household you were born into? Did you have a choice about who raised you and how? Of course you didn't. And thank goodness you didn't get raised by somebody who was, I don't know, part of a pedophile ring or something, you know, just for the sake of argument. And again, It puts the onus on the person causing the problems, yet it doesn't address the problems as they get caused to the child. And I think it's like only coming halfway. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And there is a point where a child is more involved and can be more involved in their development. We're not at that point yet.
No.
A teenager has more. Maybe I should qualify that by saying your average teenager has more ability to have input in the things of their life. And like you said, I mean, I was fortunate enough not to be born into a family where great difficulties existed. Sure, I had the crazy aunts and uncles and, you know, the nutcase cousins, but...
Who doesn't?
You know, who doesn't? But my home environment was far from sheltered, and I expressed to you some of the things that I saw as a teenager that prevented me, that really put me off being involved in some of the things that my peers were being involved with. And so that became my choice. But just being able to, you know, go out and hang out with friends wasn't an issue with my parents. And they'd put certain qualifications on, yeah, okay, you can go, but be home by, you know. And, yeah, okay, take the car, but be home by that. And as long as I didn't breach that trust, you know, then the privileges could remain. The moment I cocked up, as most kids do, there was consequences to it, and they weren't physical consequences, but they were things that I liked to do were taken away.
Could you be specific?
Probably you and I like to go to the corner dairy and play some spacey games, you know. And you know, if I stole money from my parents' wallet to go play spacey games, they'd ring up the shop owner and say, "Look, he's not allowed to come up for a period of time, and if he does, send him out." You know, it was so those were simple things that I liked to do, and the privileges were taken away.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because when I was a boy, I used to steal money from my sister's wallet and go out and play spacey games. My dad found out about it, and he actually walked me down to the dairy, and he beat me up in front of the shopkeeper and told the shopkeeper never to let me come and do that again. And I didn't. You know, it might have been harsh, but it was effective. And like I said before, you can't argue with results.
No, I swore at my... I think I was 13 or 14. I swore at my mother. You know, I'd never seen my father run so fast. And he chased me halfway down the street and gave me the beating of my life. And you know, I look back on it now and I'm like, well, I deserved every friggin' hit.
Mm.
You know? I don't necessarily agree with physical violence.
Mm.
I think, obviously, grabbing a stick is... taking it a bit too far.
Or
even the belt for that matter. You know, I was lucky never to receive the strap at school.
Mm.
And then by the time I got to school, corporal punishment was outlawed. So, you know, I probably would have gotten the cane a time or two at high school. Mm. But, you know, there are certainly other ways of doing things, but I think there's something to be said about a good sharp shot up the bum. Mm. You know, on occasion, because there are times when, you know, just talking to our little one, speaking loudly to her is quite often just as effective as a spank.
Yeah.
She doesn't like loud noises, and so when we do raise our voice, she knows that something's going on. Which, more often than not, our punishment is the taking away of something that she likes.
Yeah.
Something that she wants. And that's just as effective for us at this point.
Yeah.
We haven't had to resort to other things.
Mm.
But I've certainly had to, more often than not, what I've done is I've clapped in front of her. And that's usually an attention-getting activity for me to say, hey, focus. You need to focus on me right now because I'm saying something to you, you know, in more communicative ways to hers. But that's essentially what I'm saying to you. Focus on me. You need to listen. Something. I'm about to tell you something. Time to stop.
Yeah. You know?
And that's just as effective as a physical hit, which, you know, I'm not going to say I haven't done. There's... because she's got long hair, if she doesn't hold a hand in a situation where a hand hold is warranted, i.e. crossing the road, we just hold on to her ponytail. You know, we're not yanking her by it, but she knows that we've got a grip. You know, and it's a very loose grip, but she knows that it's there. Be like you pulling your little front tuft there. You know, you know somebody's got a touch on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not pulling any hair or anything like that at all. It's just she knows she's got a grip, and that's Okay, you either hold the hand or hold the hair.
Yeah. Well, it's a similar discipline method to how the circus would train an elephant. What they do is they, when the elephant's really young, this is not about bestiality or anything like that, by the way, you know, just to clarify.
I'm glad.
Yeah. So when the elephant's really, really young and it's first gotten away from its parents, it wants to escape from the handlers, all the time wants to escape. So what they do is they get a warata, like a really, really large metal pole and spike, and you drive it really, really far into the ground, and then they chain the elephant to it. The elephant, baby elephant will struggle and struggle and struggle, and it won't be able to get away from it until eventually it stops trying to get away. Then they can replace that massive metal pole and that chain with just a little tent peg and a rope, and the elephant will not even try to escape. Now, what this is talking about is it's talking about kind of learned helplessness to a degree. Now, I'm actually in favor of teaching that to children at a very young age and then teaching them out of it once they actually have the ability to cognitively think about the consequences of their actions. Once they can take responsibility for their own actions, then you need to teach them how to take responsibility for their own actions. But in the meantime, it's just for their protection and what have you, they need to know boundaries, they need to know discipline and what have you. And this is actually part of the way of teaching them to be responsible adults who don't run away and so on and so forth. When I was a boy, and this is something that I got reminded of while you were speaking, I don't know exactly why, but I was a really violent kid, maybe up until the age of 15 or so. But when I was really, really young, I think maybe first or second year of primary school, I think I was getting beaten up by a bunch of kids at the same time. I was surrounded with them. There was like eight of them on me, attacking me, and I bit one of them. Now, instead of the school principal disciplining any of the children that were trying to beat me up, they disciplined me for biting one of them. They hung a sign around my neck that said "dog bite," and they marched me through the school during lunchtime so that all the kids could see this naughty dog bite boy.
No. And that's something
it's cruel and unusual punishment, isn't it?
Absolutely cruel and unusual. I mean, that's just absolute stupidity.
And my parents wondered why I ran away from school so many times.
Why would you want to be there if you're going to be persecuted for being persecuted, you know, and especially by the adults? Because I consider that, you know, if I'm lacking patience and acting like a 3-year-old, then what the hell's that? I mean, I certainly believe in restorative justice in many ways in schools. There was a situation recently where our girl was found pinching lunch from another. She wasn't alone, but she was doing it with other students, and she was taking some other kid's lunch. And I got really upset with that. I was in a meeting when I got a text from the teacher that the evening had happened. And it took a lot of restraint for me not to just bust out of the meeting and come home and wake her up out of bed like, "What the hell are you doing?" But they told me that, you know, they did some restorative at the school and you know, had her open her lunchbox and the other kid pick something out. And then I was talking with the one of the support teachers that she has, and says, "Well, that's good. They tried to do something." It's one of those things, you know, again, using your elephant analogy, but I'll use like it's a cat or a dog, and they do business in the house. You rub their nose in it, but the thing is, you got to do it at the time that it happens. You know, you got to and while I don't like likening my daughter to an animal, the same kind of scenario exists that if you don't do the punishment at the time the crime is done, it's not going to be very meaningful for her. And so, you know, at the time when she's at her worst, I guess, behavior, and at the times when she's acting contrary to the ways that we would like her to act, that punishment takes place at that time and that she sees it happen. So, for example, in a situation the other day, she was just bad attitude, talking back, all this stuff. And so we took away her favorite doll. And we saw it. The thing is, for her, she needs to see it being taken away and put away. She doesn't see where it's put away, but she knows it's no longer in her possession. And so that's I guess, you know, like rubbing her face in it in a way that, and she knows that she'll be back, but in terms of the time frame, she has to wait out the time frame. And there are redeem points, like if she listens and she does her tasks that we give her to do, and she does those well, then she could actually get it back a little earlier. You know, instead of 7 days, it might be 6 days or 5 days. You know, points off for good behavior kind of thing. And but she has to definitely earn it. She definitely has to earn it. And in some ways, earning our trust. And that's the same as, you know, when she gets into teenagehood. You know, she does things to betray our trust, then there will be consequences. You know, what shape or form they'll take at the time, you know, that's the bridge that we'll cross when we get there. But
depends on the circumstance.
And definitely depends on the circumstance. But one of the things that you spoke about earlier was responsibility. And again, we talk about, you can't talk. Talking to a group of teenagers the other day, I says the problem that most of you talk about is you talk about your rights. I says the problem is that rights come with an equal partner, and that's responsibility. You can't separate the two. For example, yes, you have a right to apply for and, after successfully completing the requirements, getting a driver's license. Okay. The balance of that is that they come with responsibilities. It becomes no more a right. It becomes a privilege to hold a driver's license, and you break the law enough, the driver's license is taken off you. And one of the responsibilities is you abide by the rules of the road. And whether you agree with them or not is irrelevant. That's part of the responsibility of holding a driver's license. You break the speed limit, you're caught, you get a ticket. That's just natural order of things. That's, you know, and so
personally, I don't agree with that, because unless somebody's actually damaged persons or their private property, I don't think any real consequences should actually come up in the case. But you know,
each to their own. But I use that analogy just to illustrate the point that you do have a right to a driver's license. But you also have a responsibility, A, to yourself, and B, the others on the road. You know, and sadly, too many people, and I just use that just as an example of rights and responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, we have a right to certain things in this country, but we also have a responsibility to particular things. And I guess I understand your conspiracy theory sides. I mean, I have times when I believe certain conspiracies and times when I don't. I really don't care who killed JFK. I don't know whether Elvis is still alive, and personally I don't really care.
Incidentally, but the last two people that I interviewed actually gave me all of the names of all the different teams of shooters that killed JFK, and another guy who actually told me the reason why Elvis was assassinated was because he was volunteering for the precursor of the DEA, because he found out about a massive drug ring that was operating in America, and he volunteered to go into the government to go in and expose this drug ring. The problem was that drug ring was being run by somebody who became the U.S. president, and apparently they took him out. Yeah, classic, eh? Again, I haven't seen the evidence, don't really know, but it still sounds classic. All right, I'm sorry, I was interrupting.
No, that's okay. I mean, too often in this country we're more concerned about rights, but not worried about responsibility. You know, okay, people have a right, I guess, to bang whoever they want and produce whatever kids they want. But neglecting the responsibility of actually looking after the kid. You know, I guess that's why in some ways we're dealing with the big child support bill that we have in this country. People not owning up to the responsibilities that they have. Whether they can pay it or not, you know, I guess you take into consideration that what's happening with our situation is that IRD is collecting minimal amounts from the two biological parents of our girl. One's on a sickness benefit. I guess we think the other one's unemployed. So they're both getting welfare assistance, but we know that they are being deducted some for child support it does in no way match up the contribution that we get from work and income on a weekly basis.
I always found that really ironic, is that you get a supplement from the government that is paid for by people's taxes, and then before they give you the money that is paid for by people's taxes, they tax the money that they're giving you. It seems freaking stupid to me.
Well, it's funny, we're getting taxpayers' money from people who are getting taxpayers' money.
And it's actually,
I look at it with my wife and I, with what I earn, I pay minimal taxes anyway. But with what my wife earns, you know, she's paying a whole lot more. And so in a way that, you know, you and her and others of the hardworking New Zealand, even those on minimum wage, are supplementing these people who are, in the biological mum's case, unable to work, and legitimately unable to work. We know her circumstances prohibit her from maintaining a job of any kind. And so we've got the greatest of empathy for her in her situation. She's just the pure example of the cycle, the cycle of abuse. You know, she was abused and neglected as a child. She doesn't really know how to break that cycle, and they're perpetuated in her kids. And, you know, the other three other children, our girls' three half-siblings are all in care with their father's family members. They're not in their dad's care. And then we've got this one who's, you know, got a different father altogether. And it's taxpayers who are paying these people benefits to survive. And it's just really, really, it's sad in a lot of ways.
Well, it only takes one thing to intervene in order to change the entire course of a child's life. For instance, I mentioned before I looked after autistic boys. One boy, Arisham, I used to take care of him. And the girl who took care of him before me spent 2 hours a day at the care center doing nothing with him. Like, she wasn't playing with him, she wasn't talking to him or anything. She mostly spent her time there just doodling in a little notepad until the 2 hours were up so she can collect her money and go home. Me, I became intensely involved. I actually wanted to make a difference in this boy's life. He was spitting on people, okay? He was spitting on me. And what this girl before me did is she'd say, no, that's not nice. You know, be all like, oh, well, I know you're autistic and you know, you can get away with it or whatever. And go grab a sponge and then just wipe the spit off the jungle gym or something like that. Me, I was just like, no, take your ball away. I was like, give me back my ball. It's like, you're not getting your ball back until you calm down. All right. And, you know, I was just taking no crap from him. And after less than a month, the biting stopped, the scratching stopped, and the spitting stopped, and the listening and the being a good, happy boy who got along with people began. It's because I treated him like a normal boy. That's what everybody else's problem was. They didn't treat him like a normal boy. They thought because he had a disability that he wouldn't react to normal discipline like a normal child would. And the fact of the matter is, it's the direct opposite for what everybody else was doing. I mean, I was able to teach him words, language, things of that nature. How's the weather today, Arisham? It's somewhat moist. I was able to get him to say, even my theory was that if you could teach him long words and creative language and things of that nature, that smaller words would actually become much easier. I was able to teach him how to say the word diabolical genetics, you know, things of this nature. Not necessarily any practical benefit, but because he was actually able to form the words, and again, through this process of repetition, he was actually able to start communicating a lot better with people. And his parents told me that they saw a massive change in his behaviour. The problem was, had anybody reported me for treating him like a normal boy, I could have been fired, maybe even jailed as a result, okay, if somebody'd complained. That is how fracked up the system is.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, I spent some time working for a group that worked with adults who had disabilities, and the more independently functioning ones, like the ones who could catch the bus on their own and look after themselves in terms of personal cares. Some had autism, others had physical disabilities. Most of them just had significant intellectual disabilities, Down syndrome and the like. Lovely. Still one of the best groups of people I've ever worked with. And in terms of the clients, company was shocking, but the clients were awesome. Absolutely loving them bits. Because all they wanted to be is to be treated like a friend, like somebody who is going to listen to them, listen to their endless goings on about Shortland Street and wrestling and WWE, that kind of stuff. And and it was funny observing.
By the way, I find it very amusing that the intellectually handicapped really enjoy pro wrestling and Shortland Street. But go on.
It was funny watching them because more often than not, their daily lives revolved around Shortland Street, because one pair of clients would be in a relationship, and then the next day the staff would be sitting around the table talking about things, and suddenly there's this talk about a breakup, and the thing was, well, who broke up on Shortland Street last night? And so they were, their lives were imitating the art. It's because somebody had broken up on Shortland Street. Oh, we had to break up. We can't be going out anymore because it's not on Shortland Street. It was lovely to see, but it was quite funny. But I then reflected on my daughter. She comes home and imitates her teacher, and she gets her toys and stuff around her in a chair, and we got her a little whiteboard. That she could use to practice her letters and things on, so we're not using copious amounts of paper. And she's sitting there teaching, spending time with how her class was that day, and reading, pretending to read books and writing letters and practicing her A's and B's and C's. Got to keep on the line. Keeps on the line. It's quite funny how much her life is imitation of those she sees around her. And more often than not, that's a compliment. But when she first started doing it, I just out of my own curiosity went and sat in her class for a while, and I said, after a few days of observing her teacher, I made a time to meet with her and have some private one-on-one time. I says, I don't think you realize how much Ellie imitates you. And just having observed your class, I might suggest that you not raise your voice so much, because that's what she was imitating. There would be times when she'd be in her room, playing teacher, and suddenly there's this outburst of ranting. It was quite interesting how she was actually imitating the mannerisms and behaviors of her teacher. And we've noticed that with us too. So, we have to be careful how we act around her and try to be civil even in times of high stress. If you follow. And so that's because we more often than not become reflections of how we were raised. And so that is really important to remember about how we are around our children, because they will become basically copies of us. Even if they're not genetically copies of us, they will become full copies of us and how we act and how we behave. And the things that we value are the things that they will come to value.
Yeah.
If they don't at this specific time, these are things that, this is how my mum and dad did it.
Yeah. When I was a boy, my dad was really violent with me, and surprise, surprise, I was a really violent boy. Up until maybe the age of 15, when my mother was given a brochure by the school guidance counsellor about the symptoms of ADHD. And there were all these things like high creativity, inability to sit still, energy and intelligence and such, all these things that are actually just normal parts of being a kid, kind of, to a large degree. However, you're just like, this is a disease. Now, my mother, instead of putting me on Ritalin, paid a guy to come round to hang out with me once a week. And we'd have dinner together and watch a movie or two. All right. Very soon after, I stopped being violent because I actually had a good role model that came into my life. You know, it's just like, bang! You see a problem. Here's the solution. Here's what's missing in the boy's life. Freaking give it to him. And all of a sudden, all these symptoms, which everybody else thinks is a disease, are actually, they evaporate. Yeah. Incidentally, those same symptoms that I saw on this brochure, I saw again a number of years later when I was in university in Business 101. Guess what those symptoms were describing? An entrepreneur. I'm not making it up, bro. Okay, it's almost like the psychiatry profession or something like that has found a way to identify everything that's good and normal and exceptional in people and classify it as a disease so that they can make money off of drugging that person. Maybe I'm being cynical. I don't know.
I think there's always a place for cynicism, but where would we be without the cynics in the world?
In a society that's not totally fracked and totally in debt, with all the laws everywhere, it's just like, how many problems do more laws solve? You know, I mean, it's like a friend of mine criticized me a number of years back for only covering left wing protests. And I said, bro, there are no right winger protests, because right wingers don't protest, do they? A right winger will either go, okay, there's a problem, let's go solve that problem, and if they can't solve the problem, they can't be bothered, all right? But on the other hand, a collectivist, somebody who doesn't believe in the power of the individual, will go, I can't solve this problem, so I'm going to complain about it, and I can't solve it by complaining about it by myself, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to find a whole bunch of other people to complain about it with me and still not solve the problem. Right, and that was the interesting thing that I defined as the difference between being a hardcore right winger and hardcore left winger. There's nothing correct about being a hardcore right winger or a hardcore left winger. There's something in the middle that actually makes sense. All right, and that's why people like me always get demonized and called conspiracy theorists and everything, because I'm right, and both sides of the major argument are wrong, and that's why they don't like it, because they don't like having an argument that they've been going on about for over 100 years or so without any progress or traction.
No, and that's like, for example, you know, one of the arguments I had, and it wasn't with the MPs that I met with this last week, it was just in general, it was actually with a government supporter. And he pointed out to me that the current laws that we have around child protection, and for example, the Care of Children Act, the Child, Youth and Family Act, and its current amendments, most of them anyway, were passed by the previous Labor government, so in the mid-2000s, during the Helen Clark era. And I think I got him a bit off guard when I said, really, I don't care who passed them. I ultimately don't care who passed them. It's the people who are currently administering them. And the response I got from the minister a couple of years back, the Minister of Social Development, was totally irrelevant to the question I asked. And around similar type of scenarios where, you know, we're being placed in a position where we've got no power, we've got no support and anything like that, and highlighted things which were which were minor in terms of what I was asking her.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how these biologicals can, you know, not only receive benefits from the government in terms of welfare assistance, but also could, you know, get legal aid to take us to court and you know, basically it was their rights. And it was a similar kind of answer I got from the Children's Commission as well. Well, they're the biological parents, they're allowed to do this. And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me it's okay for a child sex offender to get or to try and get access to a child he's never met. And how is that in the best interest of the child? How is that in terms of section whatever it is of the Care of Children Act? I think it's section 405 off the top of my head.
I think there's two words that are missing from that equation. Moral fibre.
Yeah, and again, I would be the first to admit that what I would like to see happen in terms of the termination of parental rights is controversial. It's certainly not popular. You know, and I think, you know, when this finally goes to air or however it's broadcast out, comes out, there's going to be negative responses. I don't expect everybody to agree with me. I know there's going to be kickback to it.
Well, you're not proposing anything that's totally unreasonable. You're talking about an extreme case with copious quantities of evidence to support this decision and with a logical standpoint, with moral backing, and so on and so forth. Only then, under that extremely unlikely scenario, we can remove that problem from the equation. That's all you're proposing. And the thing that you're proposing would affect a very, very minimal amount of people. And I think what most people do is it's almost like you say one thing, but they don't interpret what you just said. They interpret a completely blown out of proportion of what you just said. Okay? Your argument is X, but what they say is, you just want no parents to have any rights at all, and all children to be taken away, and the state can just grab all your children, and all that kind of thing. Have you had those kind of responses?
I've had one. In talking with this over with a person in a forum type scenario, and that's the kind of feedback I got, really, was that, you know, we're taking away everybody's parents' rights. So the next person who has a child taken away from them, God, you know, that's their argument. And I says, actually, no, that's not what I said. What I said was, we have about 8,000 or more, and I think this was at the time, we have about 8,000 or more, I think it was actually close to 15,000 children in care, in child, youth and family. It may be more now. The group I'm suggesting this for is only those children who are in proposed long term, and when I say long term, it's either from birth to the time when they're actually able to become independent, so 16, 17 years of age. So children who are expecting or who are likely to be in non-whānau care, not with family members of any kind, as in our situation. You know, we're not tied in blood to this little girl in any way. And she's been with us since two, is likely to be with us until she's independent and even to a grown adult. And so that's the window we're talking about. And when you take that number compared to the number of all the children that are in care, we're talking probably close to about 4,000 children. And so that brings it down. Then you've got there, within that group, those who are in non-whānau care, there may be probably half. So maybe 2,000 children who will never go back into the custody of their biological family in any way, shape, or form that we're talking about. And when when I broke it down like that, the responses seemed to be, you know, okay, yeah, maybe it's a bit more reasonable. It's extreme. And I'm like, yeah, it is extreme. It is hellish extreme. But what's the alternative? You know, what alternatives are there to this child's future development when the possibilities are foster home, foster home, foster home, foster home, foster home equals screwed up teenager, which means non-productive adult.
Yeah.
And there is plenty of research already in the world, multiple countries, that prove that. We don't need to commission a new report on it, and that's why I felt a lot of the stuff around the Children's Action Plan and the Green Paper and that kind of stuff, while good, it's gotten people talking about a lot of things. Nobody wanted to take that extreme viewpoint that, hey, maybe we need to think about this again.
Yeah.
And I'm not advocating in no way, shape, or form, and am I advocating a return to the dark old days of adoption.
Yeah.
But what
you're talking about is exceptions for exceptional circumstances, which sounds fracking reasonable.
Yep. But because it's not politically popular and not likely to be politically popular, it won't be considered.
Look, freedom isn't politically popular. People love being slaves. People love paying unjust taxes that don't have any laws that require them to pay them. They love it. They can't get enough of it. Please enslave me. Please arrest me for no reason. You know, that kind of thing. People can't get enough of that stuff. Doesn't mean it's right.
No. No, absolutely not. But, you know, again, we talk about whose rights are we protecting? You know, and whose rights are ultimately paramount? You know, and I think one of the arguments that did come back to me was, what about the right of that child to know its biological family? Absolutely reasonable. Again, you come back to reasonable.
Totally valid point.
Totally valid point, absolutely. And what I come back to, and I says that I can only speak for our situation. We've actually got a book which we created for her fifth birthday. My wife took up a digital scrapbooking class at an adult education period over 6 weeks, learned how to use Photoshop. Before that, she'd actually done physical scrapbooking, taking her photos and things like that, put it into a scrapbook, and then she constructed this beautiful book that has pictures of her from baby to, you know, at that time to her fifth birthday, which we had one of my friends who's a professional photographer did for us for her birthday. Beautiful photos. And she presented that book to her, and it tells a story. You know, this is your first 5 years. It shows the pictures of her mum, shows the pictures of her dad, shows the pictures of her siblings, and the adventures that she's had, you know, since being with us, and baby photos, you know, that we were able to find and keep and protect for her, so she knows her story, and that's something that I think should be considered as a part, so that when she grows older and when she begins to understand more fully the circumstances that brought her to our home, you know, she starts asking questions, that the answers that she gets are truthful, that are meaningful to her, and that she can understand that, again, when she gets older, she doesn't become one of those TV3 missing pieces, documentary pieces, looking for this dream of a mother that really just never existed. She knows a little bit about my mum, you know, having passed away 16 years ago. Obviously, she's never met this person, but she knows parts about her that she sang, because my mum sang with the New Zealand Māori Chorale in the 80s. I actually have her recordings, the solo recordings that she did, and that's a bit of her history that, while she's never met her personally, she's seen photos of her and she's heard her voice. And she likes listening to, she liked as a younger child listening to her voice to go to sleep. So I created a CD for her, and so she could listen to her late grandmother singing her to sleep, because it's the same songs, funnily enough, I went to sleep with. And part of my story telling, this is my mum, this is your grandma. And when I was a little boy, my mum sang me to sleep, and so now she can sing you to sleep. And, you know, those types of things help her make a connection to a family. And if she can't connect to her biological family in a meaningful way, which is something that by their choices are preventing this from happening, that we're making that happen.
Now, this reminds me of a study that was done in France near the turn of the century, I think. There was a big religious element at the time in Paris who wished to know what the true language of God was. And so what they did is they got a whole bunch of orphans, right? Parents had died in childbirth or something of that nature. Had never really had any nurturing, never had any parenting or anything like that, never even heard a word spoken. And they put them in this one orphanage together, and the nurses and nuns and so on and so forth that were taking care of these children were instructed to never speak while around the children, so that the children would never hear a word. And their thought was that when the children started to speak for themselves, they would speak in the true language of God, right? Somehow, God would speak through them without them having any examples. Every single child in the trial died. Every single one. Without love, without human contact, you cannot survive. And what you were just telling me there about your mother singing you to sleep, and about acknowledging where your child came from, and actually teaching her that and all of that kind of thing, that's what reminded me of it, is that it doesn't matter who's giving you the love as long as you're getting it.
Yeah. And again, it's, you know, the best way to spell love is T-I-M-E. You know, and spending time with her, just reading a book, spending time with her. I do, you know, as frustrating as it gets at times, sitting in her room, making sure that she cleans, you know, shoes in the shoebox, toys in the toy box, bit by bit by bit. You're still spending time with her. I'm still spending time with her. And again, I come back to, why would I want a 9-to-5 job that's going to bring me home stressed, on top of, you know, my wife works extremely hard to support us, and I try to make sure, you know, as infrequently as I do, to make sure that the house is clean and tidy, that she doesn't have to worry about it when she comes home, and that she can just spend some time with little one, and, you know, the time in between coming home, having dinner together as a family. You know, I don't agree with everything that Family First group does, but one of the things that they sent out was a weekly planner whiteboard, you know, that you can put on your fridge. And, you know, there's a quote that on the bottom of their thing is, what your kids really want for dinner is you. You know, and I don't bring... I've stopped bringing my work, even though I work at home, I don't bring my work to the dinner table. I keep work separate, you know, in another room down the other end of the house. And when I do my work, I'm down there. And, or, you know, if I bring my work out onto the dinner table, there's nobody else here and dinner's not on it. You know, it's that time you spend with your kids that they're going to value the most. And that's what I valued about my parents was, they both worked extremely hard, but they always had time for us, and me growing up. And my two younger siblings, my older sister is adopted, my younger sister is fostered, I'm an only child, but we all got treated equally, without reservation. I mean, Chinese Maori sister and Cook Island Māori, other sister, and, you know, we don't look alike, but we're all treated the same, and the values that we have as adults reflect the values of our parents, and that's children first.
Yeah. Well, ironically, just after we talk about how important it is to spend time on your children and everything, it's my duty to inform you that this interview has run out of time.
Oh, I've really enjoyed our talk.
Yeah. Likewise. And I think we've actually, I think people listening to this can draw some important lessons, distinctions, wisdom, and even, you know, dare I say it, parenting and discipline techniques from this conversation, you know. Maybe through sharing our experiences, maybe through the fact that everybody's got a story, we can all derive lessons from those stories. And that's actually the kind of the point of this show. So, yeah.
Thank you, Vinny. It's been really good.
You're welcome. All right. Wadamu Bayliss, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
And bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, again, I reiterate, this is a listener-supported broadcast. The only reason why I'm capable of actually bringing all these different people and from the various walks of life, and whether that be conspiracy or being family man's like Wadamu here and what have you, you know, it matters not. Everybody's got a story, and for goodness sake, you may as well just sit back and listen, because you might be able to actually glean something divine from it, maybe. I don't know. But still, I need money. All right. Well, I love doing the juxtaposition from there. Okay, so if you are capable, ladies and gentlemen, of giving me some of your hard-earned cash, I can assure you that I'm spending pretty much every single day doing minimum of 12 hours, usually up to 14, 16 hours or so. Just really, I roll out of bed, I fuel myself on coffee and food, and I just get to work exposing scumbaggery and helping good people. You know, that's my job, really. If you think that's worth rewarding for my efforts, please do. If you don't think that's worth rewarding, I may disappear off the face of the earth. Who knows? You never know. All right. Thank you very much for your support so far. Thank you, Wadamu, for your time. And we will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. You are the only exception. To believe.